Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
For some 200 years now, Pentateuchal scholarship has been dominated by the documentary hypothesis, a paradigm made popular by Julius Bellhausen. Recent decades, however, have seen mounting critiques of the old paradigm from a variety of specializations, not only in biblical studies, but also in the fields of Assyriology, legal history, and linguistics. In a recent international meeting, scholars across these fields came together and presented papers, each one calling for a paradigm change in Pentateuchal research. Join us as we speak with one of those scholars, Dr. Richard Averbeck, about his contribution to paradigm change in Pentateuchal research. His chapter is titled Reading the Torah in a Better Way. You're listening to New Books in Biblical Studies, and I'm Michael Morales, your host. Richard Averbeck teaches at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. His areas of expertise include Old Testament, especially the Pentateuch, ancient Near Eastern history and languages, Old Testament criticism, Hebrew, and biblical counseling. He's a member of the Evangelical Theological Society, the Institute for Biblical Research, the American Oriental Society, the American Schools of Oriental Research, and the Society of Biblical Literature. Among his many publications, Averbeck has contributed articles to Evangelical Dictionary of Biblical Theology, Faith, Tradition, and History, Cracking the Old Testament Codes, Guide to Interpreting Old Testament Literary Forms, the New International Dictionary of Old Testament Theology and Exegesis, and Dictionary of the Old Testament, Pentateuch. He's currently committed to several writing projects, including the Old Testament Law and the Christian, A Rest for the People of God, Reading the Old Testament for the Christian Life, and a commentary on Leviticus. Dick, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to it.
Would you begin by explaining for our audience the documentary hypothesis and how it has dominated studies in the Pentateuch?
Well, the documentary hypothesis, people call it various things. It's back in the 1800s, the 19th century. It was called the new documentary hypothesis because it had so much background in the previous centuries. But it's often called, the JEDP theory for the supposed background of the J source, which is the Yahwist, that is the oldest source. Then the E source for the Elohist, using these are different names of God, and then the D source, which is Deuteronomy, and then the P source, which is the priestly material, like in the book of Leviticus. And it runs through the narrative shape too, like the genealogies in Genesis 1 and in Genesis and on through into Exodus and so on. These are generally considered to be priestly material and added in by the later priestly writer, say in the 500s BC, long after any supposed Moses. There's an assumption that there is no Moses, generally speaking, in the field, although some would say there could have been a Moses somehow. So that's the documentary hypothesis that dominated for a long time since the 1800s, connected with Julius Bellhausen. So early in the 1900s, Hermann Gunkel, another scholar, established what we call form criticism, which the purpose of it was to go back behind the sources that Bellhausen had isolated, J, E, D, and P, and look at the oral background behind them. How did they come into being? And so this was based upon looking at each particular unit, each story, and seeing what kind of cultic background they came from. We'll often hear about Zitzim Laban, the situation in life, and things like this. So it's very much anchored in the oral. And that developed then into what we call tradition history, where the concept of how the text came together was taking those oral traditions and then developing the tradition history to such a point that you build up these traditions as whole sets of stories. Then redaction comes along and it's put together in writing under the influence of a theologically weighted writer who puts it together according to his theological concerns. This developed then into another system of looking at how the Pentateuch came together, and it has come to be in competition with a newer form of the documentary hypothesis, the neo-documentary hypothesis, which is going back a lot to Wellhausen, but also correcting some of the mistakes that Wellhausen made, but trying to do basically the same thing, even more extreme sometimes in Wellhausen's dividing up of the sources. And that is now the neo-documentary hypothesis. The other process that starts with Gunkel and goes through tradition history and redaction criticism, that's taken to be a non-documentary hypothesis on the composition of the Pentateuch. And there it's built up over time through redactors in such a way. And these two, neo-documentary and redactional approaches, are now largely in competition with one another in the field. That's basically what's going on up to date here in the discussion of composition of the Pentateuch.
Now tell us about some of the growing criticism against the documentary hypothesis. What are some of its flaws?
Yeah, this is one of the main purposes of the book, was to show the flaws in that system, even in its places where it thinks it's so powerful and useful. And so, for example, in the flood story, but one of the things that has become clear, it's very circular. In order for it to work, you have to posit something, and then you take the data and come back around to prove that, when that's begging the question. And so what happens is there's a hypothesis that comes out of it. Now, it's presumably based upon the text as it stands. There, the theory is the text as it stands is not really readable. It's not really a readable text. But there's a lot of cases in which when you do the analysis of why they think it's not readable, it does not stand up under scrutiny. And that's one of the things I talked about in my essay in the book. So it's a lot of it like that. Also, they tend to use modern literary sensitivities to decide what's coherent and what's not, when really it was not written in the modern time. It was written in ancient time according to their literary sensitivities. And so we can't impose our modern ones on it. We have to see how it was read, how it would have been read, how it would have been written in the ancient world. And that requires comparing ancient Near Eastern materials. And so there's a lot of reasons why people have been pushing back on the documentary hypothesis and the redaction theory in terms of the composition of the Pentateuch.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Dick, tell us about how this book, Paradigm Change in Pentateuchal Research, came together.
Well, what happened was Benjamin Kilcare, a really good young scholar at Basel, in Basel, Switzerland, he did a really fine dissertation on the composition of the Pentateuch, where he showed how the arguments for the composition of the Pentateuch really work in reverse of the theory. And he's been working on this for a long time, and he got in contact with the other scholars, especially Matthias Armgard, and they decided that they were going to put this together as a project, as an international project, pulling together people who see these problems clearly and are willing to really work on this together as a team. And so they pulled together a team. And that was what the conference was all about. It's also connected to a similar project being done at Andrews University in Michigan, in which a number of scholars, and some of the scholars, including myself, going to both of these conferences, and there are ongoing conferences. And so what's happening is that there's kind of a team being built of people who are just coming out and saying, okay, for this reason, these approaches don't work. We have to do a paradigm change. We have to change how we think. Going back to Kuhn's structure of scientific revolutions and the whole idea of paradigm changes in how science is done and so on. And so the idea is to use that concept to think about what needs to happen in Pentateuchal studies, especially the composition of the Pentateuch.
What impressed me about the contributions in this book is the great diversity. These are not all scholars in the same field or of the same stripe, are they?
No, this is coming from all different kinds of directions and perspectives, and we enjoy that together. And this has become a really interesting environment for us to become good friends, many of us not knowing each other previously, and just building a kind of interactive context where we challenge what we do and so on. And one of the concerns, I think, that's central to what we're doing is, yes, we need to show the fallacies of the theories, the compositional theories that have been used in common biblical scholarship in the academy. But we also need to come back around and actually do our own work. So if it wasn't composed that way, how was it composed? And therefore think about a positive approach to how the text actually did come into being. How did it get shaped into the form that we now have it in? So not just negative criticism, but positive proposals about if that doesn't work, if that's not sufficient, that's misleading, then what is a good way to move forward in this discussion?
Now let's talk about your contribution to this volume. Your chapter is titled Reading the Torah in a Better Way. How about first telling us about some of the wrong ways to read the Torah?
Well, some of the wrong ways might be just what we were talking about in terms of the documentary hypothesis and redaction theory and their weaknesses and what they tend to impose on the text. One of the things that has frustrated me is they tend to see problems where there are none. And the result is they create more problems than the text does in the way that they study the text. So what I'm trying to do in that article is show that first in the earlier part of the article is to show how that's what's happening. And so I even take on one of the cases by a good scholar in the field where this particular passage in Exodus 24 and 25 is said to be unreadable as it stands. Well, quite frankly, I take on the details of the discussion and go through, there's no good reason to see this as unreadable. And the reason that's important is because this is said by them to be the reason why they apply documentary and redactional approaches to the text of the sort that are being used today, is because it's not readable as it is, So we have to see how it was composed to end up not being readable. Well, this creates a real problem in when the fact of the matter is that the text may well be readable, and in fact is readable in terms of how the ancient writers would have written, and just in terms of just looking at the logic of a passage and its context. So this is one of the main background problems that I see that has led me to be involved in this discussion. I think I want to, you know, clarify here. These people that use these methods are very bright people. They're very intelligent. The concern that I have for them and for the work as a whole is that I think they're captured by a methodology in the way they do their work, and they do it very intelligently, but they're captured by a methodology that just doesn't work. And therefore, they're kind of running in some circles. And the result is that their work is, I think, progressively losing its edge on the field. That's one of the reasons why back even in the 1970s and 80s, there was the arise of this narrative approach, this approach to reading the Bible in a literary way. Robert Alter and others, Adela Berlin and so on, where they see that a lot of the dividing up of the text that's being done by these methods just isn't literarily reasonable. And that became competition for a while within the field. And now they're kind of bringing it together with these compositional theories. And the world of biblical scholarship in the academy has become more and more pluralistic in the way that it works.
So what sort of paradigm shift do you propose for reading the Torah?
Well, what I came upon in my work on this was some material that relates to the patriarchal narratives, Genesis 12 through 50 in the book of, in which you have the Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph stories. One of the things that's really quite clear from the text is that the patriarchs worked in a family clan world. They lived in a family clan environment. It wasn't under a particular king or anything like this. It wasn't an empire. It was more of a kinship-based culture. And in fact, the patriarchs would have been what we might call enclosed nomadic sheikhs. They were sheikhs of their clan groups and so on. And this comes out in the stories in Genesis, and we have a lot of background material from the ancient Near East that supports this relationship between tribal clan groups in the midst of and in relationship to the urban centers around them. And they would have a lot of connections to those urban centers, but also be their separate groups. There would even be some family members in the clan context, some in the urban areas. There's a lot of interaction discussions that go on around this material that we have from Mari and other places early in the ancient Near Eastern context. And it's not just those texts, but texts before and after. We know that this is a common thing and that it endures down even to today. And that was why it was attractive to me to think about, well, how do these particular kinds of groups work, and how do they do history? How do they do tradition? And so I came upon Andrew Shryock's book on the Bedouin of Jordan and other things related to it that deal with these kinds of clan groups. They have a lot of focus on genealogical relationships between these different groups, and then their history is done genealogically. It's connected to the genealogies in such a way that you unpack the stories around the people in the genealogies. This is called genealogical history. And this is a kind of history that's different than our political histories. And we need to see that that's the kind of history that's being done in the patriarchal narratives. That's my approach based upon trying to find out how to approach this thing from the nature of the material, the very nature of the kind of material that it is. What would be its prehistory? How would these traditions be come into writing, and so on. And this was all part of trying to meet the text where it is in terms of what it's describing and the kind of world that it speaks from and into.
Now, given the title of your book, A Paradigm Change in Pentateuchal Research, this question may come as an underhand pitch, but what do you hope this book will accomplish?
I hope this book accomplishes just kind of a note being made in the field that there's a group of scholars out here who are functioning, trying to do serious work in compositional issues for the Pentateuch, and pushing back against both neo-documentary and redaction critical approaches to the composition of the Pentateuch, because they see real problems with what they're doing. So I hope we're viewed as people who are doing serious work and trying to engage with the issues that they're looking at in the text, and trying to not just criticize, but actually make positive proposals about how the text did come together compositionally. So it's not just criticizing, but it's trying to do positive scholarly understanding based upon what the text actually presents, and letting that drive the way we come at this issue of composition of the Pentateuch. I know that there's going to be rather, I don't know what the right word is, but substantial pushback on moving away, because that's always what happens when you have paradigm changes. There's a lot of pushback. It just comes with the territory. And so I hope that at least it gets a fair hearing. And that's up in the air yet. Will it get a fair hearing? We'll have to see, because we are walking right into kind of a lion's den of critical approaches that really is committed to their approach.
Dick, are you and the other authors planning any future meetings or publications to address this issue further?
I don't know if we'll have future meetings at Basel or not, but I know that there are future meetings. We've had two previous meetings at Andrews University in Michigan, and another one's coming up in September of 2020, in which other publications are coming out. And some of us are cooperating together in both of these environments, and others are separate to each one. So I think what's happening is that there is a growing team of people from across the spectrum, of people who just find the way the work has been done unsatisfactory, and therefore want to team up to really propose something different and show the problems and propose something that maybe goes in a better direction.
Well, Dick, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us. It's been very enlightening, and all the best to you.
Oh, thank you. I've enjoyed talking about it with you.
All right, friends, you've been listening to New Books in Biblical Studies, a channel of the New Books Network. Until next time, goodbye.